Okay, so what's on the agenda now is we're going to do the big theme on Zappa and the foundation of America and Trump and all the kind of... Oh, forget to click these things off. I clicked it up, Carol. It's still playing. Ah, that was that one. So, it's pre-election. So, America, Broadway announced that it was not going to have any shows on Tuesday night so the people could stay focused. No entertainment in New York City on Tuesday night. So it's an archetypal event. So Roxy suggested that we talk about it in the way we can talk about it, and mention Zappa as a theme. So I don't know which one's Reiner, but Reiner, would you like to be part of this discussion, or is it too late? And I don't know if I clicked you. There's 2 716 numbers. Maybe I'll do this one too.
No, I'm sorry.
One of these two is Reiner.
Gail's here too.
Gail's a musician. Yeah, I'd like to make you part of it. We've got Roxy, a student of Stockhausen and bona fide, real electronic composer herself. Gail's a composer. It's perfect. This is why you're here, from my perspective.
Okay.
The Ion thing is ongoing. You're always here for Ion. But in this context, now I don't know if Bert's here. We've done 188 hours, Bert and I and Roxy, on Zappa. Pretty interesting series. Went into interpretations that no one would accept or believe, but we know what we're doing. So, is that you, Roxy? Are you that anonymous? That one?
Yes.
Okay, there you are. And then we want Bert to be here, but it might be too early. Is that you, Bert? That anonymous?
Yes. Yes, Bob.
Oh, sure. Great. Wow, everybody's here. Now, I had invited Eben... But I don't see Eben's number here. I guess Eben didn't make it so far. She may come in any time. I didn't get an email from her. But we have Reiner and Gail. Gail and I have discussed Zappa. Gail has, through the years, we've had a few discussions. And way back in the 90s, she wasn't that keen on Zappa or didn't see my point about it and thought it was not relevant. But Gail asked me something a few years ago to define.
What was not relevant?
You weren't as enthusiastic about Zappa, I recall, back in the 80s and 90s as I was. And you were editor of Music Works magazine. You had a role there in defining whatever one did as editor, defining music for the leading edge of musical culture. And I remember once saying to you, why don't you put Michael Jackson on the cover? And you said, no way. So I felt that...
We did get him on the cover.
Wow. When did that happen?
It was an article by John Oswald.
And that would be about his whatever he did, the trouble he got in with, that stuff that he did? I can't remember.
The Plunderphonics issue. Yeah.
Right, Plunderphonics. But see, that's a context of John. It's really about John Oswald and what he did with Michael Jackson. No, I meant as Michael Jackson as a phenomenon. I remember it was around 82. Zappa was in some club, and someone played Thriller or whatever the big hit was in 82 that Jackson started to get attention, real big attention. And he said to somebody, "Who's that?" He didn't even know who Michael Jackson was. Zappa, we found out, didn't know much about pop culture, sort of, but he knew other parts of pop culture. But he said, "Who's that?" And they explained, and it didn't mean much to him, but he said, very good production values. So he was impressed with the production values of whatever that big... Would that have been Thriller? Was that his big video in 82?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was.
It was, Bob.
That's Bert from the Black Caucus. Bert would know. Bert, Michael used to be part of the Black Caucus. Oh, and by the way, Gail and Reiner, Michael Jackson faked his death. We had the exclusive on that. That was our first big story in 2009. We weren't even doing this show yet. But I was with James Martinez on his show, and we would talk to Ian privately, and then James would leak what Ian told us about what was really going on with Michael Jackson, how it got set up. He'd leak it to his L.A. contacts in the gossip press, and ended up every... We had presented a press conference with 37 items that Ian gave us that are questions about what was going on with Michael Jackson. And later, all 37 items eventually were discussed individually by different gossip outlets. So Michael Jackson has always been part of our scene here. He is. He's watching us. He interacts. He longs to know Carolyn, but doesn't want to know me, but he wants to know Carolyn. So that's led to some interesting parallel world experiences for Carolyn with Michael Jackson. But that's the background. Okay, so Gail, you asked me a couple of years ago about tactility and Zappa. Do you remember that? Was that what it was?
Yeah.
And then you, so that surprised me that you were interested, and I don't know how you used it, but that was pretty interesting. So maybe you have a different attitude than I thought you had towards Zappa.
Yeah.
I think Reiner always liked Zappa, right, Reiner?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
I did too. I didn't, just because I didn't manufacture an article doesn't mean I didn't like Zappa. You know, the funny thing about a magazine is it's not always about what the editor likes.
Right. But you're saying you couldn't direct the direction of the magazine? Is that what you're saying?
No, I said I didn't direct it according to what I like.
Oh, what was it based on?
On what you perceived? The theme was, the problem with the articles on Zappa that anybody proposed to write, and I wasn't qualified to write one myself, was that they didn't talk about the exploratory nature of sound. It's not that it doesn't exist. Of course it exists. But I couldn't find anybody who would write about it in those terms.
In relation to Zappa exploring sound.
Yes. And of course he did. I mean, you and I know that he did, and lots of other people know that he did. But it's very hard to articulate it. And that's what I couldn't find, is somebody who would articulate it in a way
Bob, why didn't you write it?
Who just said that?
Their son.
Whose voice was?
Lauren.
Oh, Lauren's here. Okay, yeah, Lauren can be part of this. What phone are you on? You on Reiner's phone?
No, I'm on my own phone in California.
Well, how did I get you in here? How did you get in?
I'm the other 716.
Oh, okay, all right. So, no, that's a good question. I mean, I was very proud of the interview me and Bob Marshall did. When I played it on CKLN, Reiner and Gail heard it. That would be late, around Christmas 1988. And I remember Reiner very impressed with the first hour, or the first time we played it, first part. Then a couple weeks later we played the second part. Reiner was impressed with the interview and Zappa. And then the third part, Reiner said, that wasn't as exciting. Frank was sounding tired. So I always remember that, Reiner, your reviews.
Yeah.
But, I don't know if I could have written something about Zappa then, on the exploratory part, I might have, but I'm not an expert on technical parts of music. I know Zappa's thinking about a lot of things, because that's the only guy I basically study, but I definitely could talk about that, and that is what our panel, me, Bird, and Roxy, did. Because Zappa was the first ideological explorer, post-John Cage, in pop music. Can't say in electronic music, but he did use newer equipment faster than people. So Zappa is the archetype for me.
We have a Zappa-related piece in the music room by a Montreal artist named Raymond Gervais, and he did a whole bunch of artificial CDs with imaginary sounds on the inside. Mm. In other words, there is no actual CD, it's just the cover. And
right.
A whole series of them are people that were inverted in linear time and were influenced backwards. So he has a CD of Varese listening to Zappa, and it's on our wall.
That's a cover, no content.
Right.
The content exists in your imagination.
Right. Well, you know, it's very interesting because when we were doing this 6 months, 8 months ago, I found a quote by Zappa way back there in the late 60s saying the content of Uncle Meat and his albums was not the message. he actually had that idea about what he was doing. And it's hard to figure out what was his message. It might have had something to do with marketing, or I don't know. But I see Zapp as a great prophet of what Ion has said, has come forth to say. Matter of fact, we like to talk about when Zappa went as a teenager, he would, to determine who he would hang out with, he would play them Ionization by Varese. And if they didn't respond to it, did someone laugh or say something? What was that?
I laughed.
Okay, good. So he would play that in high school to people, and if they didn't like it, didn't respond, then he wouldn't hang out with them anymore. So, and remember, it's a piece called Ionization. Or the album call, I can't remember. Yeah, I think it's the piece called Ionization. Look at that, Ionization. What, Gail?
That's
yeah.
Right. It's the title of the piece of music.
Yeah, and he would play that Ionization. And here's this guy who's going to be influenced by me at some point or later, predicting Ion by using the word Ionization as a litmus test for his social life. That's pretty good. I don't know if he called it xenochrony, but pretty interesting anticipating. Like his living actions, the actions of his body and clothing were miming what was coming. So that was very good. We made a lot out of that about Zappa. But let's see, what else say about him? But he did say that the content of his album was not important.
There's two different things about Ionization. One of them is the name of the piece, which is one way of defining the piece. And the other one is defining the piece by the sounds that it contains, which is exactly the kind of thing that's very hard to articulate. So using Ionization, the composition or the sound experience, actually, as a kind of a benchmark, that's the same issue with Zappa. It's how do you articulate what it is about the piece, which is not something in language. Like the word Ionization has a bunch of meanings, and the words in Zappa's music have a bunch of meanings, but there's something in the sound itself that is very hard to put in words. And that applies to both Varese and to Zappa.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, he said the present-day composer refuses to die, quoting Varese. And it really matches the Finnegan, the Menippean tradition, as Eric McLuhan or Marshall would define it, more Eric in writing. You know, you got Rabelais and then Alexander Pope and Swift, and you go through the satirists of literary history and you come up to Finnegan's Wake. How the hell do you write about and talk about that? And then people didn't know how to talk about McLuhan. So it is part of the tradition that Zappa entered musically. The untranslatable Menippean satirist or some kind of...
it's the untranslatable part. And I guess perhaps this little Ionization test that was being performed in high school by Frank Zappa was a test of people being able to accept something that wasn't easily wrapped up and sloganized.
Yeah, or conceptualized. It was raw percept. Yeah. And the mind looks for concepts. And that was McLuhan's agenda, too.
Is it fair to say that Ion is also part of the Menippean tradition then?
Yes, every tradition is included Ion. Ion knows everything about everything, from the stupidest TV shows to the most esoteric aspects of the Emerald Tablets, which we have provided to the public. I've had over 8,000 hours with Ion, and I'm pretty knowledgeable, and I can bring up a lot of range of topics, and Ion's always been on top of it. Matter of fact, it was hard to believe the first couple of years. I thought he was making shit up or something, but no, now I can see it, and also he can make any invention. And what Ion is saying is the most phenomenal thing in history, and all of art and science has come to this point. They all were attempting to contact non-physical. That was the deep root of all human yearning and creativity. And then Carol and I pulled it off. So we make that a theme in our discussion of Zappa, and I've done many videos with Roxy. She's the expert on appreciating this. She has a good knowledge of art history. And what would you say, Roxy, about what Gail's saying about Zappa's content is pretty hard to verbalize. Have you got an idea about that?
Yes, how do you translate in words what's happening in sound? Sound is a very complex phenomenon. So yeah. I suppose that's what she means.
And Zappa was exploring sound perceptually. He always said, I do my stuff to find out what it sounds like. And we asked him, okay, you raised the question, who are the Brain Police, you know, back in the 60s? Who are the Brain Police? What do you say to that? And he said, I'm still working on it. I'm not ready to make a statement about who the Brain Police are. So that's pretty interesting because many other people by the 80s were claiming to know who the Brain Police were. You know, they might cite MK Ultra, they might cite HARP stuff. There's all kinds of theories going on, even in academia about advertising. But Frank, I think he had the right answer. We can't answer that yet. And then Ian has come forth to really up the ante on the mystery landscape and factors that none of us have ever thought about. Ian does say, in a religious concept, new things, and has said they've said this, that humans have never heard before. And you have to hear a lot of it, Reiner, to find that, but it's been incredibly innovative.
Yeah.
Well, yes, in the...
I'm trying to get a handle on how to approach what I would like to ask, so...
Right. Go ahead, Roxy.
In the prologue of Subliminal Suggestion, is that the name of that... by
Subliminal Seduction.
Seduction.
Yeah.
Marshall McLuhan said there is something called auditory imagination, and it's this capacity of poets to change the rhythm of normal speech.
Yeah.
To communicate something that goes beyond the logic of the words, that goes into what we call the subliminal. That there is some other understanding of what the poet is saying, not only by the logic of the words, but by these rhythms. And I think that's what the big innovation of Zappa, that he is being a poet with sounds. He was doing polyrhythms and many harmonies at the same time and trying to make this big conglomerate of sound and without being too abstract. So that's really,
you're right.
I think, mastery.
Okay, no, that's a really good point. Let me read you what T.S. Eliot said about the auditory imagination back in 1933 in his book, The Use of Poetry and the Use of Criticism, a particular essay called Matthew Arnold. Eliot says, what I call auditory imagination is the feeling for syllable and rhythm, penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word. Then there's a semicolon and then a next clause. Sinking to the most primitive and forgotten, returning to the origin and bringing something back, seeking the beginning and the end. Then there's a period. Then he says, it works through meaning, certainly, or not without meanings in the ordinary sense, and fuses the old and obliterated and the trite, the current, and the new and surprising, the most ancient and the most civilized mentality. Now, that is a pretty amazing statement. And,
could you send me a link to that? I really need it. It's directly related to the way I use text in my music, and I need to get that quote.
Okay, so I will just grab it right now and... Okay, it says there's a larger website, but it's right at the top. I'll send you the link. I can do it right now. Email, and I think your name will come up. Yeah, Ridge. Begins with Ridge, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So, A-D, A-I. Oh, auditory imagination, artificial intelligence. Holy shit, look at that. I'm just putting in the initials. Artificial intelligence, AI, auditory imagination. So
okay.
There it comes. Now
that's
here's
great.
What...
That's a real Manipian trick there that you just... That's fantastic, too.
Yeah. So listen to this. McLuhan wrote a letter to Playboy. This is what I always cite when this quote comes up. In 1970, and he says... The auditory imagination of T.S. Eliot and from the 30s is ordinary awareness today. Then he says, what has not entered the waking life of people or the world is Finnegan's Wake. Now, that's a really important point about what's the difference between Eliot's auditory imagination and, we could say, Finnegan's Wake, which is tactile imagination. So that's what I work with. And I always bring that point in, is that the average citizen has become, where did I put that thing, has become someone preoccupied. You would see it in Comedy Central. They are always exploring sound and puns and popular phrases and situations. And then it becomes synesthesic or synesthesia, where people are hearing what they're looking at. They're touching what they're eating. The mixture of the senses in the Global Theater is what McLuhan predicted, and Finnegan's Wake wrote out this multimedia mixture. So it's interesting that Eliot is a very profound statement. You have to understand it, but McLuhan felt we'd move beyond that. So let me restate this.
Yes, no, I just like to say something.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, and that was also what Zappa was trying to achieve. His goal was to do this big deal of opera, embracing all types
all of media.
Of media and coming from all sides, like surround systems, and he was really trying to achieve what Joyce did with the Finnegan's Wake. And
he said that to me through the Evergreens. He admitted that. He was aware of Finnegan's Wake, and yeah, he was trying. He did a quote back in 1970. He says, music has fallen behind sculpture, painting, and the other arts. And he felt he had to bring music up to speed with what the other arts were. And I found out later he was thinking of things like Finnegan's Wake, which was a book which swallowed everything up to that point, the most avant-garde thing, and he wanted to make his music approximate that. But he never spelled that out to my person. Yeah, go ahead.
Music and language are one, because, like Marshall McLuhan said, it's the thing that connects all generations of humans from the beginning to the now, is the continuity of language, this big composition. And language is rhythm, is frequency. And that's why Ion calls speaking the right way the new song. It's music.
Yeah, he calls it the frequency. Now, a few weeks ago, I did I took those four or five statements by Eliot and turned it into a tetrad. And I'm trying to find where that is in my inventory here. I like to read it. I don't know if I could say it, how I did it. I forgot, probably. But I took the aspects and showed how Eliot was describing the different parts of a tetrad. So say something else while I look for that. Anybody can.
Blah, 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 blah.
Blah, blah, blah. Blah, blah. That's avant-garde there, Gail. That's pretty avant-garde. That's good. There's Gail seeking the roots of the beginning.
That's Joyce. The end
of the roots. Yeah, Joyce. Right. Yeah.
It's one of the thunder words.
Hey, Reiner. Yeah. Ion can talk, move its lips or JW's lips. Ion doesn't always speak through JW. He can just be a hologram and speak. But he can move his lips so fast that they start making electronic vibrating sound. That's what's pretty inhuman about Ion. He can go blah, 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 and then make his lips go so fast it becomes a buzz, which is pretty hilarious.
Well, he is pretty hilarious.
Yes, he is. I said to James Kidney in 1985 when Sheila Gostick came over, she was a CBC comedian, writer for CBC.
Yeah.
And out of the blue, as I was saying goodbye to her, I said, I intend to become the funniest person who ever lived. I don't know why I said that, but with Ion, it is possible to be the funniest person who ever lived. Ion is the funniest. I don't think anybody can be as funny as Ion consistently for many hours every week. You know?
Yeah.
So, Roxy, do you know where I put that tetrad on Eliot's quote? Do you recall when that was, a few months ago or a month ago? Doesn't come
maybe,
up.
Maybe 2.
Maybe 2 months?
We were already in November.
Yeah, I don't maybe think it was November, but let me try it. Searching, not come. Came up. Ah, there it is. So maybe I got it. Okay. So I say, take this quotation from Eliot that McLuhan never stopped milking. So I gave the quote, and then I said, then take the first four quadrants from my tiny note chart, and one can apply the four themes of Eliot's definition of the auditory imagination to the four quadrants. Sinking to the most primitive and forgotten, returning to the origin and bringing something back, seeking the beginning and the end, I say that applies to the Ezra Pound, Lynn LaRouche radio dialectic humanist quadrant. Then the sentence, the feeling for syllable and rhythm penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word, that applies to the TV, Wyndham Lewis, Marshall McLuhan rhetoric modernist quadrant, not humanist. Then the section, it works through meaning, certainly, or not without meanings in the ordinary sense, infuses the most ancient and most civilized mentality. That applies to the computer, to T.S. Eliot, William Irwin Thompson, grammar, and the Buddhist quadrant. And then the section fuses the old and obliterated and the trite, the current, and the new and surprising applies to satellite, W.B. Yeats, Arthur Croker, postmodernist, anarchist quadrant. Then I said, oh, look at this. The letter to Playboy in February, March 1970. I quote, T.S. Eliot's famous account of the auditory imagination, says McLuhan, has become an ordinary form of awareness. But thinning its wake as a comprehensive study of the psychic and social dynamics of media remains to be brought into the waking life of our world. You know what I said that quotation applies to? The Dobbs quadrant. So okay, I gave myself prominence there. But that's not the tetrad, so let's see if it comes up again later. Yeah, for some reason it doesn't come up, but if I look at the words now and rethink it, which would maybe sinking to the most primitive and forgotten, returning. So that would be extending. That would be the extension, the first phase of the tetrad, extending. The feeling for symbol and rhythm penetrating far below, invigorating every word. I don't know, is that retrieval? And then it works through meaning, certainly not without meanings in the ordinary sense, fuses the most ancient, the most civilized mentality. Maybe I didn't do a tetrad on this. Maybe what I just read is what I did. So I don't know how to fit this into the tetrad. What would be, it flips into, I can't even see a flip here. Fuses the old and obliterated and the trite, the current, the new and surprising. Maybe that's flip. So I may be wrong. Maybe I meant this, applying it to quadrant. So I dropped the issue. Let's move on to something else. But I did try to break apart the quote into different parts. So, Gail, you're looking at it. What do you say about it as you look at it?
Oh, I don't have my computer. I'm all on audio right now.
Oh, okay. So, let's see. What? So Zappa, okay, going back to this quote. Just a second. I blipped it off. Do you have the quote there?
I can go get it.
No, Roxy. Does Roxy have it there?
Oh, okay.
Let me see.
No.
Yeah, let me try. Let me bring it up again. It should be able to come up. Just a second. Okay, there it is. Okay, so you look at the feeling for syllable and rhythm penetrating far below the conscious levels of thought and feeling, invigorating every word. I think you see that in Lumpy Gravy, came out about 67, 68. You see Zappa playing with normal speech and funny rhythms, funny odd expressions, like he would just tape these people, record these people talking inside a piano. So I see him talking about below the conscious levels of thought and feeling. I think that would be what McLuhan calls percept. Sinking to the most primitive forgotten and returning to the origin, bringing something back, seeking the beginning and the end, that was his search for the big note. It works through meaning, certainly, and not without meanings, the ordinary sense. That would be Zappa's sort of practical, he was a financial conservative and a social liberal, but he ran for president, he was always talking practical. He wouldn't allow marijuana to be around his band as much as possible so they could perform well. So that practical part of working with normal meanings, despite being an absurdist, is fit Zappa. And then fusing the old and obliterated, the trite, the current, and the new and surprising, the most ancient and the most civilized mentality, that definitely is him, you know, carrying on the tradition of Edgar Varèse, the refuser composed to die, refuse to die, but then he's hanging out and interacting with all the pop music and satirizing it or using it. He was not ignoring the new and surprising. So the whole thing, so Zappa is the ultimate of expressing the auditory imagination, as Eliot said it, but he was trying to move towards the tactile. And that's why I appreciate Gail asking me about Zappa and tactility, because I think that he was a tactile artist more than a sound artist, even though he could rely on great sound as content. He had a tactile message. Now, tactility is the interplay of senses, not any particular sense. So if you're making an art where the content is not the message, but the non-content, that would be defining tactility, as McLuhan said it. It's not a sense. It's the interplay. And he talks about that when he talks about time, that time cancels out each other if time was wave-like. And then he says, from the distance, it would look like an object. That's a pretty interesting... and he says, we aren't going anywhere. I have to find that quote. But okay, go ahead. Someone talk. Which way? Do you want to bring up the themes? Yeah, go ahead.
Could it be? I remember when we were discussing Zappa that he was intrigued by the guitar because he said it left him with the electric guitar, that it left him with more potential to create. And then tying that in, it could be electricity, because that's something McLuhan was fascinated with. Or he saw the change in culture and everything supported by the electrical environment. And Zappa used that to the max. I mean, he was creating all the time with sound, especially with the synclav. So it looked like that Zappa, what he was trying to discover was just his interaction with the electric environment and how much potential creation he had, maybe.
Well, anybody want to respond to that?
Yeah, I would say you could add to that by saying, this is Reiner, the electric guitar also becomes a kind of a catalyst for, or let's say, it becomes a sort of a departure point for many other possibilities under electric conditions. So the guitar, because of the familiarity of the fingering board and the strings, but then with the addition of all kinds of electronic devices, it can be extended into crazy kinds of intermixes of sound options and sound possibilities. So I think he probably saw the potential of that and certainly started to use that. When I saw him live, I mean, some of those sounds that he was pulling out of the guitar with switches and other goodies that he had, the guitar just became a launching pad, essentially.
Yeah.
The guitar is a launching pad.
Yeah, basically, creating. Guitar with all the pedals that are available, the sound could become anything. It didn't have to limit itself to clinically guitar sound. So but the guitar's familiarity as a fingerboard, as an ancient instrument, that a stringed instrument that goes back in history thousands of years, suddenly becomes this electronic device that can catalyze all kinds of options that are infinite, really.
Well, in, as a person listens to the music, they imagine the guitar as a tactile experience, and that makes it central. And the synclavier is much harder to imagine for most people as a tactile experience.
And why would that be?
Well, you can always think about your fingers doing the walking, right?
Yeah, you hear guitar, you can. It's familiar enough, and it's common that most haven't, like half the people around, have tried to play it. And so it has. Everybody has a tactile experience of guitar. Not, I shouldn't say everybody, but probably most of the listeners.
Yeah. Right. But not a tactile experience of the synclavier.
Right. Right.
But I think Bob is talking about tactility not only in the experience of touching, but it's
yeah,
more like
contact.
During the Gutenberg galaxy, the visual was dominant, and then with the electric environment, we went back to the acoustic, and with the Andromine, we go back to the tactility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe ultimately, the mixing of the senses is the tactile world that's being referred to, but at the same time, the potential of the guitar also becomes a multi-dimensional sound experience as well, and maybe it doesn't reflect tactility in the same way, but certainly in terms of its infinite possibilities, it certainly expands the language.
Yes, because even Zappa
was talking
about music being a type of sculpting with the air molecules.
Absolutely.
So that's
tactility.
The tactility.
Tactility sculpt.
Like at a molecular level, the frequency that I also
awesome.
Mentioned.
Sound is spatial, sculpting is spatial, formal, so yeah, those relationships are real.
And what about the fact that people compose, you know, virtually all the time now, and they're experiencing imagery and sounds, but they're not holding it like a guitar? So the chip body experience of the Android meme is not much in the chemical body. So Gail's citing a chemical body tactile experience, trying holding a guitar.
No, it's not a chemical body. It's imagined. It's not physical.
Yeah, but just a minute, I want to see what Gail means. You were talking about people have tried guitar. You said that,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I did.
So what's the imaginative part of that?
It's when they hear Zappa playing it, they have the memory of having done it, which makes their experience, it gives a tactile dimension to their experience of Zappa.
Right. The contact part of their experience. Moving the fingers is not contact. That you're using the interval. So yeah, okay. So they've had. So I call the digital world, which the synclavier is part of, as the tactility squared. So it's tactile, but it's a virtual or a nothing, or nothingness squared. That's what he got into, composing digitally with the synclavier. So he was dealing with tactility squared. You know what?
Yeah,
Walter Ong talked about
with the synclavier, it's the same. The tactility is at the same level of the guitar, but it's more abstracted because he's working with actual physics. Physics of sound instead of with the. But a lot of those sounds have tactile resonances in our imagination.
Yes. So I found the quote. So here's Zappa in 1970-71. He says, "I believe the basic stuff of the universe is in the shape of waves, not subatomic particles. Then, if the two components of the universe, waves and time, are actually one, And if a wave equals a wave, all time equals all other time, and you aren't going nowhere because you've already been there. Now, that's very Ionic. Always
yes,
talking about how we've already done it.
It's Ionic, but it's also related to one of those breakthroughs in physics that happened about a year ago.
Yes, you mean the neutrino?
No, I forget what it was called, but it basically said that the wave, something is a wave, the basic element is wave.
Right. And then what's that one, Roxy, you talk about? Remember about a year ago they discovered something like what Gail's saying? There was some big...
Vibrational waves.
Right, is that what you're talking about, Gail? Right. So Zappa was onto it.
Yeah,
Einstein talked about those waves possibly existing, and a year ago they think they found them.
Gravitational.
Yeah.
Right,
gravitation wave. Now, ion, with ion, we immediately, and Roxy brought it up, or I did, but I think Roxy did, and I then went through about what that was correct, but what was wrong. See, with ion, we can immediately frame it and not be stuck in awe of the scientists or whoever discovered it and their garble about it. With ion, you get a precise criticism or appreciation of it. That's what's incredible about having ion. And I mean, remember, you did discuss it with ion, right, Rox? You discussed that experiment.
Yes. He said that was the proof that there is no time. The fact
right. Yeah, so that's
so
what Zappa says. What, Gail?
Music takes place in what we call time, and it's very interesting that it doesn't exist.
Right. So Zappa's saying, and so he says, then if the two components of the universe, waves and time, are actually one, and if a wave equals a wave, all time equals all other time, and you aren't going nowhere because you've already been there. Then he says, viewing this whole mechanism from a distance, it would just be a solid object. That's pretty good. So he said that in 1970, and that was molding his idea, including, you know, Gail's friend Pauline Olivero. Does it have an S? I can never remember.
Yeah, it has an S.
Yeah, the Oliveros.
Yeah, Pauline Olivero's Zappa. In around the time he's saying this, he's talking about a work she made in the mid '60s that he got influenced by or thought it was pretty good.